my father sniffing coke for that matter. We all wanted a brief moment when reality didn't matter, when we could finally forget our messed up situations for a minute. Usually it was an effective, albeit temporary, way to cope. Except for angry drunks. I really can't stand someone who is mild-mannered most of the time, but put a few Henny and Cokes in them and they start snarling, like they want to take your head off. Those people are filled with anger they can't control. They don't know the source of it. They just know they are mad and they need to release some of it on the world. To me, an angry drunk is a person who wants someone to talk to, but doesn't know how to ask. They end up in such a rage that they start crying and breaking down and telling their whole life story. That's why therapy is so powerful, because it allows you to get that shit out without the drugs and alcohol and without breaking anything. And if booze is your problem, Alcoholics Anonymous could be a good form of therapy. It is a group, but it's also free. And I hear there are meetings in just about every town at all times of the day. Therapy helps those who help themselves. It's strange to me that black folks have such a hang-up about asking for assistance when it comes to our emotional issues. In almost every other instance, black people have zero qualms about asking for help. Black people are usually quick to ask for anything, a job, a date, a ride, $5 to put toward a bag of weed, you name it. I can't tell you how many brothers come up to me and say, "Yo, Charlamagne, put me on, man." They're not asking for a specific job or position. They're just asking me to wave a magic wand they seem to think I have and make them famous. No hesitation, no sense of self-consciousness. You need something? Man, you better ask for it loudly, with confidence. In the words of Kevin Hart, say it with your fucking chest. But ask for help when it comes to mental health? Whoa, slow down. You're tripping. For too long, emotional help has been the one thing we've been uptight asking for, even though we know to a person that the pain is there. I doubt there's an African-American listening to this program who isn't somehow connected to that pain. Even if their own life is on track, there's someone in the world, a parent, a sibling, a close friend, who is struggling emotionally, who is silently suffering as a black person in America, yet still isn't asking for help. But it's like Zora Neale Hurston said almost 100 years ago, if you are silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it. We can't be silent any longer, especially when a lot of that pain is being inflicted on us by others. Thankfully, I'm beginning to sense the change. I hear people talking about therapy, openly, without embarrassment, offhandedly even. Maybe it's because now that I'm in sessions myself, people are sharing with me, telling me that they are currently going or they want to in the future. The same way someone might say, "Yeah, man, I need to get back in the gym." Now they'll say, "Yeah, I need to link up with a therapist." Really, there's not much difference. The gym helps you get your body right. The therapist helps you get your mind right. It doesn't even make sense that you would celebrate one and shy away from the other. They're both great ideas. We all share so many of the same fears and insecurities. I have friends who might have grown up in the Bronx or Detroit or L.A., maybe even during different eras, but when we talk about it, we see that we often share the exact same pain and the exact same trauma. And once we can admit that, the pain that used to feel so heavy suddenly begins to lift. We are actually able to laugh about a lot of this because we've all been through it. We realize it's not just us alone on an island. And if you're still hearing that old refrain, "Don't put your business in the streets," ringing in your head, remember, confidentiality is one of the cornerstones of therapy. Knowing that you can say anything to your therapist and it will stay in the room helps you to build trust to open up. All therapists are legally and ethically bound to keep their sessions confidential and not discuss them with anyone else. Basically, they have a no-snitching policy. You don't choose a therapist chooses you. The first thing a lot of people ask me is, when is the right time to go? I don't know if there's a one-size-fits-all answer since so much depends on your personal situation. I can say this. For me, approaching 40 felt like the perfect time to start unpacking my life. I've always been someone who trusts my instincts, and a couple years ago, my instincts told me, time to let go of some of this baggage you've been carrying around. Time to let go of a lot of attachments and fears that I've been needlessly letting weigh me down. In the past, whenever I felt unsure of myself, I trusted that I had mentors to lean on. Two very impactful ones were Dr. Robert Evans and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. People I could go to for guidance and wisdom. But as I began to become more and more successful, I noticed a shift in my relationships. Instead of finding mentors, I was becoming the mentor to a younger generation. People wanted to ask me for advice. I was becoming a go-to guy for a lot of people. and I loved helping them. But as I always say, who does the go-to guy go to? For me, the answer was a therapist. That was my path. But by no means do I think you need to wait until you're approaching middle age to talk to a therapist. High school kids need someone to talk to. College kids definitely need someone to talk to, especially if you're going to a school that's taking you outside of your comfort zone and exposing you to different people and ways of life. I've never been to college, but I have to assume that it can create a lot of anxiety and insecurity. Most colleges provide mental health counseling. If you feel like you need it, take advantage of it. It's no different if you're just starting out in your career. You should still definitely try to find mentors and OGs in your profession who can guide you and help you avoid pitfalls, but that might not be enough. Your OG can show you every shortcut and help you make the right connections, but if you're weighed down by a lot of unnecessary emotional baggage, you're still going to struggle to get there. Maybe even waste valuable years running in place instead of getting where you're trying to go. Be honest with yourself. If you're young and ambitious but struggling with anxiety, make therapy a priority. I know when you're just starting out, funds are tight. Therapy might not seem like a necessary expenditure, but if you need it, it damn sure is. Probably the very best way you could spend the money. In fact, let's talk about how much therapy costs, since it's an issue that stops a lot of folks before they ever get started. I won't lie. On the surface, therapy seems expensive. Personally, I pay $150 for an hour-long session. I do it out near my house in New Jersey, but if I was doing it in Manhattan, it might crack $300. Nationally, prices tend to range between $75 to $100 per session. I know if you're on a budget, that might seem like an astronomical price. $400 a month, you might be screaming. That's more than my car note. I get it. It's a lot of money. But I also promise you it's a fantastic investment because you're investing in yourself. Getting your mind right is going to get you a lot further and make you a lot more attractive than a new pair of Yeezys or having an updated iPhone or buying a new pair of distressed jeans. By the way, what's up with buying brand new jeans that look raggy? Why do your jeans look like your emotional state, all worn and tired? Your jeans look like they need some form of therapy. If you have insurance, call up your provider and see what sort of therapy they cover. Most insurance companies provide at least some level of coverage, though a lot of them set a limit on how many sessions they'll pay for over the course of the year. Take advantage of that coverage if you have it. Even if your insurance won't pay for all your sessions, they can at least put a big dent in your overall bill. If doing therapy weekly is simply out of the question financially, then start only going once a month. If you start seeing the results, and I expect you will, it will become easier for you to prioritize weekly sessions in your budget. You'll start to see why it is actually more beneficial than new shoes or going out to eat all the time. If you don't have health insurance, many therapists also work on what's known as a sliding scale model. That means they take your yearly income into account and charge you according to what they think you can afford. So while I might have to pay a therapist $150, someone else might be able to get sessions with the same person for $75 or even $50. A lot of shrinks don't advertise that they'll use a sliding scale, so it might be on you to speak up and ask if it's a possibility. Don't be shy about it. It's very standard in the industry. And even if it turns out not to be an option, you're not playing yourself by asking. There are even some therapists who are willing to work pro bono, which basically means for free. Again, they're not going to advertise that. But if you have a compelling case on why you need therapy but can't afford it, don't be afraid to ask. Most are empathetic people by nature, so chances are they'll at least listen to you. If they don't work pro bono, maybe they'll recommend a colleague who does. If having an African-American therapist is important to you and you don't know where to start, you can check out AfricanAmericanTherapist.com, which is a national list of black therapists, counselors, and psychologists. You can also check out PsychologyToday.com, which keeps a searchable database of African-American therapists. TherapyForBlackGirls.com also has a really helpful listing of African-American therapists by state, as well as a cool podcast about the experience of getting therapy. You might also check out online therapy sites like Talkspace that allow you to talk with a shrink at cheaper prices than you would for an office visit. I personally like sitting down face-to-face with someone, but online therapy might be a way for you to at least get your foot in the door and start experiencing the benefits. Another option is group therapy. In addition to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, there's the group Beyond Addiction. There are plenty of group therapies designed to offer more general counseling and support, and they usually cost about a quarter of what individual sessions run. If you think you'd be uncomfortable talking about your issues in front of other people, try out a session and see how it goes. You don't have to say anything if you're not feeling it. At worst, you've sat there for an hour and listened to other people talk. You've wasted plenty of other hours in your life. Giving this a shot won't kill you. But if you do happen to like the setup, it could be a very cost-effective way for you to get the support you need. Also, if you're worried about money, be sure to contact local hospitals and community agencies. Many of them offer low-cost or free therapy with graduate students who are working toward getting their therapist license. Yes, you might get someone who's still figuring out their approach and style, but there's really no downside to it. At the very least, you're getting someone to talk to and work things out with. And often the students are supervised by a licensed therapist. So you might actually end up getting two smart people helping you for the price of one.
How to choose a therapist. I'm Dr. Ish. The road to living your best emotional life is full of challenges, and it takes real courage to decide you need to find a professional to help with this. Unfortunately, it can feel intimidating to choose from all the different types of therapists. Hopefully, this section will ease some of the anxiety. There are three main categories here to consider: psychiatrist, psychologist, and counselor. Big differences between the three. First, understand that all three can be highly trained therapists. Now, let's take a closer look at what each actually does. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor, or MD, who went to college, then medical school, then residency, and is trained as a general practitioner but specializes in psychiatry or mental health. Their primary function is to restore brain balance in terms of neurotransmitters and chemicals, and as such are qualified across the board to write you a prescription in the efforts to help you do so. Depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and ADHD are some of the main diagnoses they treat. In addition to prescribing medications, some psychiatrists are uniquely trained to do therapy as well. A psychiatrist's knowledge is broad in terms of being able to pull from the nearly 300 diagnoses in the Mental Health Diagnostic Manual, or DSM-5, and identify exactly what diagnosis pertains to you. A psychologist, by contrast, is not a medical doctor, but he or she went to college, then graduate school, and has a doctoral degree, and is just as highly trained in mental health and oftentimes is a damn sight better at therapy. They are masters at behavior modification and are uniquely qualified to help you break pathological patterns, change old dysfunctional behaviors, and shape new productive behavior. Typically, a psychologist will only do therapy, but in certain states, some are qualified to write prescriptions as well. If a psychiatrist's knowledge base is broad, a psychologist is deep and highly specialized. A counselor is exactly that, your wise counsel. They went to college and likely majored in psychology or social work and obtained a master's degree or became licensed to perform therapy. So they're not as specialized as the other two, but are much more readily available and accessible in terms of providing you care. Your counselor's primary function is providing you support and guidance while teaching you specific life-building skills along the way in all areas of mental health. Counselors only perform therapy. Counselors do not write prescriptions. And if any of them ever offer you one, run. A counselor generally uses more basic therapeutic techniques to help you with a wide range of life issues. When you hear someone say, "I have my therapist on speed dial," they're usually referring to a counselor. A common misperception and big point to understand is that among the three, they all can be considered your therapist as they all can be trained in specific therapeutic techniques. It's rare to find a psychiatrist who's equally as well trained in therapy, but in the event you do, keep them. Often, people will start with the counselor, and if there's no improvement, they'll go to a psychologist. If your psychologist determines there may be an underlying chemical imbalance, they'll often refer you to a psychiatrist. But the reverse also happens when people's primary care doctor will refer them directly to a psychiatrist for treatment. Then the psychiatrist will uncover pathological patterns or major life issues that will require more in-depth therapy to resolve. You can get better with either medications or therapy, but the secret sauce to your cure lies in doing a bit of both. Depending on what issues you're working through, medications can help you from hitting rock bottom while you get to work on processing your underlying emotions and learning new life skills. Goodness of fit. Once you figure out the specific type of professional, the next thing to consider is goodness of fit, which is equally important. it's best to get a recommendation for a couple of reasons. One, it's a small community, and within that community of professionals, we know who's good and who's not. And two, depending on who's referring you to whom, they'll have a feel for what you specifically need in terms of therapy or meds or both and get you to the right person. All mental health professionals have specific areas of focus or areas they're much better at than most, and that reputation is known in the community as well, so take advantage of that. It's best to see at least two or three before you settle on one. If I may use a relationship analogy, you want to consider this your "I'm dating people, but no one exclusively just yet" phase. Date around. You'll know the right fit when you meet them because you'll feel connected, you'll feel like they listen to you, and you feel like they genuinely care about helping you with your problem. If you don't feel those things when you're in their office, you're in the wrong office. There are some key areas you want to take into account before deciding on who's going to be your provider or providers, because people often have both a psychiatrist and a therapist or counselor, that you wouldn't think make a difference, but in actuality can be huge. Gender. Depending on what you've been through, particularly if it's a sexual trauma, you may be naturally more comfortable with a male or female. Sometimes your referral will be made based on that or based on whom you need to become more comfortable with to move forward in life. Also, their age is a huge factor. Again, in certain cases, it may be best to pick someone older than you, particularly if there may be some old unresolved mommy or daddy issues. Even though it shouldn't be, obviously ethnicity can play a factor. It helps if you both speak the same language and get some of the same cultural cues. Some people are just more comfortable opening up to someone who looks like them. They tend to feel that person gets them, even though the opposite may be true. This is a particular problem in the African American community because, as a whole, we don't seek mental health treatment nearly as much as other ethnicities, and when we do, the chances of us finding somebody in the chair who actually looks like us are slim, especially an African American male. So if that's what you're looking for and you hit the lottery and find one who's good, stay right there. You're home. Outside of those genetic match factors, there are other things you want to know. For certain, you want to know their area of specialty in terms of what they treat and what techniques they use. Every mental health professional can treat you for most issues, but will customarily have a specific area of focus where they're proficient. Trauma, depression, panic attacks, mood swings, personality issues. They usually specify on their website and use that area of specialty as their calling card. Also, you want to be aware of the different therapeutic techniques or psychotherapy your provider has at their disposal. The most common type of therapy is supportive therapy because when we're not feeling our best, that's the most common thing we need. Support. Supportive therapy consists primarily of active listening and of varying degrees of comforting, encouraging, reassuring, and advising. Just knowing someone is there and giving you their undivided attention relays a sense of significance, and that goes a long way. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is the next most common type of therapy and consists primarily of your therapist challenging your automatic and often wrong assumptions about yourself and how the world in which you live works. The goal is to break your dysfunctional patterns by helping you consciously decide what you want to think, feel, and do in any given situation. Thoughts control your emotions. Your emotions control your behavior. Behaviors control your actions. Your actions shape your life. Important stuff, so don't leave it to chance. Then there's a classic free association type therapy, or Freudian psychoanalysis, that we've all seen on TV. You come into the office, sit, or sometimes lay back on their couch. They say, "So tell me about your mother." And off you go, freely associating while they're connecting the dots. The main thrust here is to uncover the root causes of your emotional conflict and identify exactly why you think the things you think and do the things you do, with the ultimate goal of giving you control to direct those things once you're made aware. Outside of those factors, there are definitely more practical things to think about. Access. Does my insurance company cover these visits? A quick call to your carrier can clear that up. Also, what are the professional's specific practice rules of engagement? How and how often can you contact them? Visits per month? Calls per week? Texts per day? Email whenever? Their office staff can inform you of that when you call for an appointment. Be honest with yourself, and if their program doesn't sound like it fits your needs, call someone else. Last, you want to consider length of treatment. Traditional psychoanalysis can last for years, but in this day and age, to quote Sweet Brown, ain't nobody got time for that. And quite honestly, it's very likely not necessary. Consider brief psychotherapy when there's one specific issue you need to move past, and that can last anywhere from 1 to 3 months. Problem-focused or behavioral modification therapy is best for a cluster of symptoms and can last up to a year. Supportive therapy is just that, surrogate support, and can last indefinitely until you feel like you're ready to walk it like you talk it. I think the most crucial thing to consider when trying to find a good therapeutic fit is to find someone who you feel listens to you and genuinely cares about you doing better. They are there to lend you ego strength and believe in you until you're ready to start believing in yourself. Just like there's the perfect person out there for you to love, there's also a perfect mental health professional out there waiting to help you heal.
My therapist is a white woman. No disrespect to Dr. Ish, but when I decided to see a therapist, I wasn't as concerned about whether they were a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I just knew I didn't want a black therapist. No, not because I hate myself and want to bleach my skin white. I just wanted to sit down with someone who felt like my opposite. My reasoning was that I wanted someone who didn't have the same experience as me. I didn't want them to have the same biases and preconceived notions that I do about situations. That might sound like it runs counter to everything I've been saying so far, but I wanted my sessions to be unique. I wanted them to be about me. I wanted someone who was going to be listening to me in a vacuum instead of associating me with their own experiences. I didn't want someone black, and I didn't want a man, but I also didn't want a white woman. So I initially set my sights on an Asian therapist. I booked an appointment with an Asian woman in New Jersey, but while I was waiting for that session, my assistant told me she went online and found a highly reviewed psychologist just 15 minutes from my house with an immediate opening. Only issue was that she was a white woman. I can't lie. Since my schedule is so hectic, being that close to my house was a big attraction. It's not that different from picking out a gym. It's helpful if it's close to your home or work. I decided to give her a shot. I wasn't expecting much, but lo and behold, I liked this woman's energy. I value energy above everything else, so that was huge for me. But what really sold me on her was that she keeps a big bowl of Werther's Original Caramel Candies in her office. I've always loved Werther's Originals because they remind me of my grandmother. She would have those at the house when I was a kid, so just the sight of them brought me immediate comfort and helped me feel relaxed. Despite my preconceived notions, I decided to stick with the good energy and classic candies. It just felt right to me. And now, every Friday, I look forward to sitting down with my white therapist and unpacking my life. I found the best thing about talking to a white therapist is that it's one of the few times a white person is actually shutting the fuck up and listening to the issues that we face as black Americans. The way I see it, not only am I benefiting from the sessions, but maybe, just maybe, these interactions will change how my therapist sees things. In turn, she'll talk to other white people, and in time, it could lead to more white people using their privilege to combat prejudice, to truly attempt to be a part of the solution to the problem white people's ancestors created and benefit from today. In the words of the great urban philosopher Doughboy from Boys in the Hood, either they don't know, don't show, or don't care about what's going on in the hood. So those one-on-one interactions between black people and white people at the therapist's office do just as much for them as they do for us. Now, maybe you're a little blacker than me and a bowl of candies isn't enough to make you feel comfortable spilling your guts to a white person. I respect that. If that's the case, then you should look into finding a therapist who looks like you and might have a little bit more insight into your experience. Plus, it's great to support a black business, especially a small one. Be warned, though, there aren't nearly as many black therapists out there. According to the American Psychological Association, just 2% of its members are African American. But you can still find them. Psychology Today has a national listing of African American therapists on its website. The Association of Black Psychologists has a listing of members on its website as well. And online therapy options like Talkspace allow you to request therapists by race and gender. If for some reason you aren't able to find a black therapist or one you vibe with, please don't let that be the obstacle that stops you from getting help. You might have to go out of your comfort zone, both emotionally and physically. If circumstances dictate it, you might have to drive to the white folks' neighborhood to meet your therapist. If that's the case, don't feel uncomfortable. Don't feel like you're somewhere you're not supposed to be. Getting help is your right. If it helps, remember that one of the reasons the neighborhood is so nice in the first place is because a lot of the people there have access to therapy. They collectively have their shit together. So instead of being intimidated, grab a little bit of that community's energy and take it back to the hood with you. Do you know what therapy looks like? I've been talking a lot about why you should try therapy, but I want to highlight what an actual session is like. Because therapy is such a private moment, you don't even hear too much about how those 60 minutes play out. We've seen little glimpses of sessions on shows like The Sopranos or in movies like Antoine Fisher and Good Will Hunting, but very few people have a real sense of what happens. For the most part, because most folks aren't going to go into much detail about their session. Luckily, I'm not most folks, and I'm pretty comfortable sharing personal things, so this is how it goes for me. My therapist's office is in a space she shares with other therapists. There's a little waiting room I sit in from when I arrive until she comes out to greet me. Pro tip, you want to arrive for your appointment on time. Therapists rarely let a session go over, so they usually run on schedule. If you show up for an appointment from 3 to 3:45 at 3:15, you're probably only getting a half hour, but we'll still have to pay for the whole thing. Once I get into our room, the setup is warm. That's the best way to describe it. It's always dimly lit in a comfortable way. I remove my coat if I have one and sit on her couch to talk. She sits in a recliner about 5 feet away facing me. There's a little glass table with the candies between us. I know there's the classic image of lying down on your therapist's couch, but I don't like talking to people while I'm lying down unless I'm in bed with my wife. Or maybe on a beach chair. Overall, I don't feel really engaged when I'm lying down. I prefer to look straight at someone and have the conversation face to face. Then we start talking. She'll usually start the conversation by asking me how my week was, but generally, she doesn't lead me too much. If I ask her a question, she'll respond, but there are plenty of times I'll say something and she'll let my words hang there without a response. She's never explained why, but I've noticed that when she does that, it forces me to go deeper into whatever subject I'm talking about. I've become comfortable driving the conversation, but if you're black, it might take some getting used to. Black folks are used to getting a lot of affirmations during their monologues. If you're black and tell someone, and then I told him I wasn't trying to hear that, the person I'm talking to might say, damn straight, or I know that's right. If the person you're talking to doesn't say anything, it might actually throw you off. You might think, is this person even listening to me? In therapy, they're definitely listening. But don't expect much in the way of feedback or encouragement. Chances are your therapist isn't going to say, that's right, or word, every time you tell them something. You're going to put stuff out there, and they might not say anything back in return. They'll just wait for you to keep going. Don't get thrown off by that. Embrace the silence and keep digging deeper. Like the Philadelphia 76ers star Joel Embiid says, trust the process. If you feel like your therapist is either talking too much or not enough, then discuss it with them. It's a perfectly legitimate thing to bring up. If you don't like the way a trainer is working you out, you would say something. Or you would tell a massage therapist to either go softer or harder. It's not different with a therapist. The session is about you. And in all likelihood, you're paying a pretty penny for it. If you want the style of the session adjusted, you can say so. If you do and you feel like your therapist was offended, then they're probably not the right person to be your therapist. But please, don't quit on the process. Accept this wasn't a good fit. And then start looking for someone else. A friend recently told me she met with 4 different therapists before she found the right fit. Now she goes every week and considers therapy, along with losing 40 pounds, the most impactful thing she's done for her overall health and wellness. I think it's also important to remember that you're not trying to be friends with your therapist. Your mission isn't to impress them or paint the best picture of yourself. Don't censor yourself because you're worried about what your therapist might think of you. I still struggle with that from time to time. I'll catch myself getting in my head and worrying, man, what is this woman thinking about me? She's an older white woman, and I wonder if I'm scaring her with my tales from the hood. In the end, I trust that she's professional, and she's just there to help. Those little worries aside, I really look forward to my session each Friday afternoon. To be prepared, I keep notes of things that bother me during the week, so we'll have relevant things to discuss. This is a practice I believe will make your sessions much more effective. Everyone has things that bother them each week. Keep a little notebook by your bed and write them down before you go to sleep. When you review them at your session, you might see there are patterns in what's bothering you. I also jot down unresolved issues from my past that I feel is still weighing on me. Currently, one of the things I'm discussing with her is my father leaving my mother for another woman. Some others are my inability to confront death, getting molested as a child, regret over the crimes I committed. I'm going to talk about many of these issues in greater detail in subsequent chapters, but for now, suffice to say that they are far from unique. I know a lot of folks with almost the exact same issues. The problem is that as a community, we aren't dealing with them. We are just taught that it's normal and we've got to learn to live with it. But why would you want to live with something that is literally killing you? Holding on to all that trauma of the past is killing us slowly, eating away at our spirits and poisoning our bodies. It's also hard on our relationships and our kids. We end up taking shit out on people we are close to because we don't have a good way to unpack these things. That's why I love venting to my therapist, dumping all this old stuff on her that I should have gotten out years ago. This is yet another reason why a therapist is great, because who else can you get to help you unpack all the old baggage you're still carrying around with you? It's very important that you have that person in your life. Like Erykah Badu said in Bag Lady, you gonna hurt your back. Dragging all them bags like that. I guess nobody ever told you, all you must hold on to is you. I know therapy is working because when I don't go, people around me can always tell. Recently, I was out of town and missed two straight sessions. Man, I was so stressed. Everything that was happening in my professional life had me completely riled up. I was on the phone with Angela Rye running my mouth about everything that was going on when suddenly she cut me off. You haven't been to therapy, have you? She asked. Nope, I replied. And then it hit me how stressed I really was. I wasn't even conscious of it, but I had been feeling so much anxiety. And that was after missing only two sessions. It pains me to even think about how much stress I've been carrying around all those years I wasn't going to therapy at all.
The fear of therapy, clinical correlation. This chapter offers a much needed fresh take on an age-old problem. Black people don't go to therapy. African-American women maybe, and much more likely these days, but African-American men, forget about it. Out of the 350 private clients I'm currently seeing, three of them are African-American males. It just doesn't happen, and there are a lot of reasons why that is that need to be examined. The first of which is that, as hard as it is to believe, therapy is still a big taboo in the black community for many reasons. There's an inherent distrust of the process and an irrational fear of what negative consequences could arise as a result of sharing too much of your world with a stranger in a perceived authority position. Is it possible you could let something slip in therapy and they, in turn, have to alert the authorities, like the Department of Social Services, APS, local police, or otherwise to your activities? Extremely rare. The goal is to help you correct those maladaptive patterns of behavior before any of those agencies ever have to become a part of your life. There's also this deep-seated notion in our community that admitting to having any emotional issues to each other or to ourselves is a sign of weakness or being soft. As black men and women, we want to see and desperately need to believe that we, in fact, are strong, because our strength can, in turn, help us get through our tough days. It actually doesn't. It just delays the process of us truly healing and moving forward. You cannot heal what you're scared to reveal. And in being fearful of being transparent, we miss the tremendous opportunity for personal growth. A common therapeutic practice is to break you down before building you back up. As African Americans, some of us already feel so beaten down, we just want to avoid feeling any worse. But in avoiding our issues, we miss the healing, growth, and empowerment that come on the other side of a breakthrough. The other bit of pushback that I see from people who have tried and failed to find a connection with a good therapist is that they say, they just didn't understand me, or they didn't seem to really care. Fair criticism, and one that as a professional working on the inside, I get just as frustrated with. To my horror, I found over the years that there is an all too frequent basic lack of cultural competency when it comes to white therapists helping African-American clients, especially young black men. We are consistently misdiagnosed with labels like conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, and schizophrenia. Either we're a behavioral problem or psychotic, which is nonsense. I've also seen there's a general lack of understanding of our cultural cues and mannerisms, how we connect interpersonally, and what we actually respond to in terms of feedback. From the first day of my psychiatry residency to the last, I was lucky enough to have as my mentor the first African-American psychologist in South Carolina, Dr. Jerome Hanley. He was brilliant, compassionate, and ever vigilant about making sure every mental health professional understood who we were as a people and why. I still smile remembering the night he brought actual slave change to a doctor's dinner meeting and dropped them on the table. Everybody was shook. He believed it was our duty as African-American mental health professionals to help ensure that the very real social constructs of economics, politics, and race didn't continue to shackle or limit the lives of the people we are here to care for. While our technology does have the tendency to loosen our actual connections to each other, there are some very cool therapy apps that are helping to bridge the gap. The Talkspace app in particular can be as anonymous or personal as you're comfortable with. And if you're just starting to be exposed to therapy, this may be an excellent entry point to getting the help you need. The other thing we fail to take into account when considering why we've traditionally been so averse to therapy is the conditioning we received. Africans in America were forced to grow accustomed to a very different type of therapy since we've been here. The lash and the whip therapy. Again, we live what we learn. If that's what's done to us, 9 times out of 10, that's what we're going to do to others. Not because we don't know it's not right, but because it's just the only thing we know. Our foreparents learned to handle us, their children, with the same coarseness with which they themselves were handled. No talking, just whipping. Just like every family needs a hero, so does every culture. Charlemagne is given a much-needed voice in helping us find the courage to help ourselves. Another takeaway from this chapter in terms of our barriers to treatment is the way we judge each other. As African Americans, culturally, we've been taught to notice and exaggerate the small differences in each other rather than embrace what's the same. Old versus young. Light skin versus dark skin. Muscular versus skinny. Smart versus not so smart. Clean cut versus thug. Weak versus strong. It leads to a very deliberate black and white way of relating to each other and doesn't allow room for a lot of acceptance or emotional currency. One of my favorite tenets of psychiatry is that two things can be true. Charlemagne drives this point home. You can be right and wrong. You can have both positive and negative qualities. You can be both loving and callous. You can be a good man and still cheat. One thing doesn't necessarily cancel out the other. In our community, we're quick to pass judgment on and write each other off rather than take the time to sit and be still with the deeper issues because they make us uncomfortable. Once someone in the community suspects you or a family member may be in therapy, there's a whole laundry list of negative judgments they may attribute to you. The saddest part about that is that oftentimes they have, or someone close to them has, been struggling with the exact same challenge but afraid to face it. So instead of standing out and doing the thing that takes courage, the natural psychological inclination is to desperately try to fit back in and do what everybody else does. We self-medicate with alcohol, marijuana, or pills. We manufacture other behavioral distractions or focus on other people's problems just so we don't have to deal with the problems of the person looking back at us in the mirror. Short-term fixes for long-term problems only lead to more long-term problems. We have to find a way to let each other know that it's okay to have issues and to look to someone outside the community for help. One of the first things I tell every new client who's reluctant about therapy is this. If the people you know and the things you've been doing to fix this problem were working, you wouldn't be here. It's time to try a new way.
Chapter 5. Losing My Roots. I think everyone should do therapy, regardless of what you do. Hip-hop was built on telling the truth and being honest with yourself. It was meant to be therapeutic. A quote from Logic. I spent the last 20-some years working like hell to overcome my humble beginnings. I grew up in a single-wide trailer on a dirt road in a small town where the most exciting thing to do on a Saturday night was get fucked up and walk around the local Walmart. I was a young black male in a southern state where the Confederate flag still flew over the state house and being black could get you killed if you weren't careful. I got kicked out of 2 high schools and never went to college. I was fired from 4 radio jobs before I finally landed at the Breakfast Club. Those are hurdles that would have knocked a lot of people down. I managed to rise above them. Today I can say I'm one of the most successful radio hosts in the country. All praises due to God. Plus, I'm building a media empire that one day I hope will rival those of my media idols like Steve Harvey and Ryan Seacrest. I'm in a fantastic spot in life. And for some reason, that scares the shit out of me. I'm not frightened by the temptation of drugs or alcohol. I'm not worried about my access to available women. Okay, not anymore since I am a member of the Faithful Black Male Association. I'm not even that concerned about making more money. My bank account already has way more zeros than I ever imagined it would. No, one of the aspects of fame that's proven the most difficult to navigate is wanting to stay connected to my roots. Will losing my link to home also lead me to lose my sense of self? It's a difficult question because I'm not 100% sure exactly who I am in the first place. I believe a lot of African Americans feel a similar anxiety, either consciously or subconsciously. As a people, we talk a lot about black culture, but I'm not sure any of us really know what that is. It sure isn't black Twitter. Culture, by definition, represents manifestations of human intellectual achievement. While I concede that black Twitter has produced some fire gifts and memes, and has also brought awareness to the injustices that black and brown people face at the hands of the police, overall, I don't think social media represents our intellectual achievement. If anything, it's collectively making us dumber. Don't get me wrong. Over the centuries, African Americans have done an amazing job of creating cultural content in America. From jazz to blues to hip hop, we've created something beautiful out of our collective pain, emotions that have resonated throughout the world. America made us start at the bottom of the ladder and then put a foot on our head whenever we tried to climb up a rung. We managed to succeed largely off the strength of our content. To quote our biracial brother from the 6, we started from the bottom, now we here. Let's take the current state of rap. The white man couldn't stop hip-hop if he tried. He did, however, manage to pacify it. When rap started out, you had young brothers and sisters from the street getting paid by talking about subjects that were conscious and had socially redeeming value. They were creating songs that planted positive seeds in young people's minds. I know because I was one of those young people. Artists like Rakim, Public Enemy, Wu-Tang Clan, Boogie Down Productions, Outkast, and Goody Mob did so much to expand my intelligence and consciousness. Then in the 1990s and 2000s, the landscape changed. I've worked in radio a while now, and I've come to believe that there are forces that encourage rappers toward lyrics about violence, drugs, guns, money, and degrading women, instead of the knowledge the old school MCs were dropping. Negative energy, which is destroying our communities. It's troubling because I believe if rappers today thought they could get paid from being positive, they would. They don't believe that, though. They can sense that there are forces out there that would prefer they stay negative. Those forces are much more comfortable with rappers talking about how many Lambos are in their driveways or Gucci's in their closets, instead of talking about revolutionary figures like Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X, the kind of names I was used to hearing in songs. All that respect for history and philosophy has disappeared, which is a damn shame because hip-hop brings people together like weed and alcohol. Imagine if all those young people having been brought together were encouraged to study real history and ask tough questions about what our government has done to people. What would happen then? A lot of people currently in power would find themselves out on their asses. Ultimately, as impactful as jazz, the blues, rock and roll, of course we invented that too, and hip-hop have all been, they have always been viewed through the prism of white America. We danced jigs because the slave masters wouldn't let us cross our feet. We sang the blues because life as a sharecropper was so tough. We created jazz because we were shut out of the classical music conservatories. We created hip-hop because no one would listen when we tried to tell them just how bad things were in the hood. Today we're starving for a pure form of culture, a culture that isn't a reaction to how white people have treated us. That's why we gravitated so strongly to Black Panther. As soon as that movie came out, you saw black folks all around the country doing the Wakanda Forever handshakes and calling white folks colonizers. We want to touch our African roots so bad that even a fictitious homeland feels more real to us than what we have here. When I heard stories about Africa growing up, they made sense to me. When I read the Grimm's fairy tales, I understood them, but I couldn't feel them. When I heard African fairy tales like the tortoise and the hare or the monkey and the shark, man, I felt those stories all the way to my soul. Those stories let me know that no matter what our conditions were here in America, we were descended from something greater. That we were capable of telling our own history and sharing our own wisdom. I probably felt that connection strongly because I grew up in the Low Country. That's an area spanning the Carolinas where the African culture brought there by slaves hasn't been diluted nearly as much as it has in the rest of the country. A lot of folks in South Carolina are Geechee, which, if you don't already know, refers to descendants of slaves who lived along the Low Country and still speak a dialect that's closer to some African languages than English. Recently, I visited Charleston's future site of the International African American Museum, which will honor the victims of the Middle Passage. It's going to be built on what was once Gatson's Wharf, which is where almost 50% of African slaves entered this country. If you look at a map, you can see why the port had so much traffic. It's pretty much a straight shot from Charleston to West Africa. The museum is set to open in 2020, and my hope is that one day it will be as popular as Ellis Island. It sure as hell deserves to be. The hundreds of thousands of Africans who were brought to Charleston literally lost everything. Their freedom, their families, their homes, their cultures, their languages, and in many cases, their lives. Yet, out of all that misery and loss, their descendants have been able to build new legacies. Standing by the water and feeling the presence of my ancestors in the air helped me remember one thing. We might have been brought here as slaves, but we didn't start off in this world that way. That's a seemingly obvious point, but it's also one that can get lost in the white man's version of his story. The history books start with us in bondage. They don't teach us about the thousands of years before that. The years during which we were kings and queens and built empires, in which we traded with nations all over the world and created libraries and universities. It's almost as if the story we've been told starts in the fifth or sixth chapter of a book. I want us to be able to go back and read the foreword, the introduction, and all the opening chapters so we can put our experiences in context. Our story didn't start with being kidnapped and sold, and it's not going to end with us being second-class citizens either. Where I'm from. Learning the truth about my roots is becoming a passion as I grow older. I refuse to only think of myself within the context of black, sovereign, or American. It's too limiting. Imagine an Irish-American guy from Michigan only being able to frame himself within the context of white or the Midwest. That would make him feel like something was missing in his story. He probably thrives off being aware of his Irish heritage, even if he only celebrates it on St. Patrick's Day. Just knowing it's there gives him a sense of identity, a sense of self that's deeper than America. I want the same thing for myself and my family. That's why I'm so excited to learn what the white man has tried to conceal from me all these years. I'm not just black, but I've learned I'm Balinta, Mandinka, and Mendi, real peoples with real cultures. I want to visit the areas those tribes come from. I want to experience those cultures firsthand and then bring some of their wisdom and teachings back to the States with me. If you're black, you need to get information right now. We can't be fearful we don't know who we are anymore. Personally, I'm tired of wondering, am I a black man from the South with felonies and without a college degree who somehow beat the odds that were stacked against me? Or am I the descendant of kings and queens who has actually inherited my birthright, who has walked into the greatness that should have been expected of me all along? The answer is, I'm a descendant of those Balinta, Mandinka, and Mendi kings and queens. The Mendi people have been known as fighters. It was Mendes who took over the Amistad during the passage from Africa and eventually earned their freedom. The name Balinta comes from the term those who resist. They were people who managed to resist colonization and have held on to their traditions. The Mandinka are the descendants of the Mali Empire, which during the 13th century was the richest on earth. Its library at the University of Sankor had more than 1 million manuscripts. The point is, I'm supposed to be someone who fights against my oppression in America. I'm supposed to love books. Hell, I'm supposed to be rich. That's what's in my DNA. Even with that knowledge, I'm still struggling to figure out just how much my American roots mean to me. For years, I would have said they are the foundation that all my success has been built on, that without them, I'd fall apart. I'd be nothing. But these days, I'm not so sure. Are my roots holding me down or keeping me tied down? Deeply rooted. Make no mistake about it. My roots are firmly in the soil of Monk's Corner, South Carolina. That's where I was raised. It's where I had some of my best times and a place where I learned some of my hardest lessons. For that reason, Monk's Corner will always be my heart. I'm going to host a turkey drive for Thanksgiving every year in Monk's Corner. I'm always going to sponsor a back-to-school book bag giveaway for the students. I'm completely committed to my Third Eye Awareness Foundation, providing mentorship for teenagers in the area. I absolutely owe the town those things. Outside of charitable work, I also rely on the town for emotional stability. As I wrote in Black Privilege, I still go back from time to time just so I can sit on the porch of my grandmother's house. She's long gone, but when I sit in the southern silence, people up north don't know what true silence is. I can still feel her presence. I can tap into some of the strength that she possessed as a Black woman in the South in the days of segregation. That strength passed to me in those quiet moments continues to sustain me. In Black Privilege, I wrote, "In order to get your equilibrium right, you must return to your core. If you can still physically go back, jump in the car or on a plane and get there ASAP. Lie in your old bed and reconnect with your old dreams. Sit on your front porch and remember how you felt as a young man or woman. If your relatives aren't around anymore, close your eyes and talk to your grandma or your grandfather or the auntie who raised you. Celebrate that the street you might live on now is nicer, but also embrace that dirt road you grew up on. Appreciate that all your power emanates from that dirt and that you wouldn't have it any other way. You'll probably shed a few tears, but they'll be empowering, not painful." I still believe that, to a degree. As I continue with therapy, I'm also realizing that I've attached a certain amount of anxiety to losing touch with my roots. I worry that if I don't keep going back to Monk's Corner, don't spend some time every year sitting on grandma's porch or in my old bedroom, I'll somehow lose a vital part of who I am. I'm not so sure that's true anymore. If anything, I've started to think that I've created unnecessary anxiety for myself by trying to be too attached to my roots. The truth is, hanging out where you're from after you've left for bigger things can be stressful. You have a strong desire to keep it real. You don't want folks to think you're too big time to rub shoulders with them anymore. You want them to see that you're still the same old G. The problem is not that you change, but the people around you do. If I go out to a bar or a club back home, especially with family, one of two things will always happen. Either someone will want to buy me a drink or ask me to buy them a drink. If I don't accept the drink, I'm an asshole. If I don't buy everyone else a drink quickly enough, which I always do, by the way, then I'm an asshole. It can feel like when they see me, they're on some, "Oh, this nigga thinks he's a star shit." And then they go out of their way to show that they don't give a fuck about me. I wanted to relax, but it felt like I was always being tested, always being watched. It was stressful. It got to the point where I felt like I didn't have anything in common with them anymore. That's the loneliest feeling in the world, to go back home and feel like the connection is gone. The only time I feel a little comfortable is when I'm home on holidays. Not because they remind me of happy memories. We didn't celebrate holidays, but because that's when most of the other people who found success in the larger world come home too. Those are who I feel the strongest connection to. People who were raised in Monk's Corner but left to achieve success like me. To be fair, there are still a couple, and I mean a couple of folks in Monk's Corner, who I am comfortable hanging out with. There's my man SP, who used to hustle out on Highway 6. SP's a good dude who held me down when I got off the streets. When I was trying to throw parties and make a name for myself in radio, he'd always show love and gave me money for events. We also had very similar taste in music and would have great discussions about the latest happenings in hip-hop. SP left the streets behind a long time ago and today has made a good career for himself in construction, so I never get the sense that he is looking for anything from me. And most important, he doesn't act strange. We still hang out and shoot the shit about hip-hop like we always did. Last year, I got us tickets to the Clemson-South Carolina football game in Columbia, and we had a great time driving to the game, arguing about how rappers of today stack up against the MCs of our era. We've always had a lot in common, so the conversation still flows as easily as it did when we were kids. There's also my cousin Kente, who runs my Third Eye Awareness nonprofit. We're still tight, but truthfully, we're more likely to hang out outside of Monk's Corner. Sometimes Kente will come along with us on family vacations or visit me in NYC. Every year, he also throws a dope-ass house party during the holidays. It's always fun as fuck because nobody is acting strange. Again, the key word is strange. When you achieve success, it's almost like people are expecting you to act different. So they start acting different first as a defense mechanism. Get a grip on your insecurities and act regular, please. Outside of those two, I can truthfully say there isn't really anyone else I'm checking for when I come home. A few years ago, I would have been afraid to admit that to myself, let alone write it in a book. Today, I accept that it's my truth and I'm not running from it anymore. That doesn't mean I'm big-headed or that I think I'm too good for the folks I grew up around. It just means that I've evolved and I'm comfortable with what I've become. And if you're going to act strange, then I don't want to be around you. If anyone in Monk's Corner feels a way about me saying that I don't want to hang out when I come home, then consider this. My father has his own little club. Down south, we call them Sugar Shacks in Monk's Corner. He doesn't even want to be in the business anymore because of the shady characters who come through. My father has told me that he's had to call the cops several times because folks are selling drugs outside under the tree in his yard. Why in the world would I put myself in that situation anymore? So I can say that I'm still keeping it real? I'm keeping it real, all right. Real far away from any nonsense that might land me in a compromising situation. One of the absolute worst things black men are taught growing up is that we've got to keep it real. And most of the time, keeping it real involves some type of criminal activity. It's a lie told by people who are jealous of our potential. People who are envious we might actually make it out of a situation they hate and can't get out of themselves. Anyone who tells you that you need to keep it real by coming back to the hood is actually fake as fuck. Any love they profess to have for you is hollow. If your people really love you, if they ask you to stop by the hood and you say hell no, they won't get defensive. They will understand. That's why if the homies saw that you had a talent that might get you out of the hood, they tell you to make your move and never look back. Anyone who tells you, yo, you are lame if you come back and don't kick it with us, is a fraud themselves. Only time you will see me back in the hood is when I'm giving back to the hood. Pulling up just to kick it is a waste of time. And I want to be clear. I don't mean the general community I come from. No, you will see me kicking it in Monk's Corner, Columbia, or Charleston all damn day. I'm talking about the hood, the streets, up under the tree, whatever you want to call it. I'm not going to give myself an unwanted anxiety attack trying to keep it real for y'all. I have to keep it real with myself first and foremost. When I was in the streets, I could never understand why guys would want to come back to that lifestyle. I had homies who got scholarships to play football in college. In the hood, getting a sports scholarship is like getting one of Willy Wonka's golden tickets to the chocolate factory. It's a chance to create a whole new life for yourself. You get to go off to UCLA or Miami or Michigan and experience something different. You get to start a new journey on someone else's dime. What could be better than that? I would think not much, but so many of those guys would head home as soon as the school year was over. They could have been working out at school or getting paid from some cushy job a rich alumni set up for them. They could have been doing summer internships or just hanging out in their frat house, kicking it with sorority girls every night. The types of options that are often open to you when you have a Division I football scholarship. So when I'd see them around town, I couldn't help but think, nigga, what are you doing here? Why are you getting high under a tree in Monk's Corner when you could be living your best life down in Miami? They never seemed to have a good answer. They'd grumble about how they were tired of having to depend on their parents for money. How it wasn't fair that the NCAA was making so much money off them, but they never saw a dime. They'd hang around town for a few months and then inevitably get caught up in the dope game. Since there aren't many other ways to make money in Monk's Corner. When it was time to head back to school in the fall, a bunch of them never went back. They just hung out in Monk's Corner selling drugs and getting high. A couple of years later, they'd look up and realize they'd pissed away their best opportunity for success. By then, of course, it was too late to get another scholarship. Too late to get noticed by the NFL.